Chapter 2. Wednesday, 10:05 hours to Thursday, 01:35 hours. In which more is learned about the Middleton household. Two men have an Oriental experience, and both Reginald Webster and Thompson Ventnor are at home to the too kind reader. Tang Hall, dear reader, of which there has been repeated mention in the preceding chapter, is a housing development or estate which lies to the east of the centre of the city of York. It is a largely low-rise estate, with steps within the buildings, enabling tenants with flats on the upper floors to access their homes in keeping with the tenement design in Scotland and continental Europe. In addition to the low-rise flats, there are also streets with linked housing and pairs of houses at ground level, with each house comprising of the ground floor and one upper floor, plus attic space and a small back garden. The estate is of a red brick appearance and dates, in the main, from the 1920s and 1930s. It is, by and large, neatly and cleanly kept by the local authority, which maintains the small front gardens and the hedgerows which separate the gardens from the pavement, and ensures that they are neatly trimmed. It is an estate wherein motorbikes are chained to the lampposts, and where old motor cars line the curbs. The majority of the adults under pensionable age are unemployed, and many are known to the police. It is widely regarded to be the least desirable estate in York in which to live, but it is, nevertheless, an oasis of gentle manners and good conduct when compared to the notorious sink estates in cities such as Mossside in Manchester, Easter House in Glasgow, St. Paul's in Bristol, and Seacroft in Leeds. One man's floor, the gracious reader might ponder, is another man's ceiling. Carmen Farrow drove the car into Hewley Avenue on the Tang estate and halted outside number 237. She and Thompson Ventnor found Hewley Avenue to be one of the streets in which the buildings were in pairs, with a ground floor and an upper floor, with small back and front gardens. The road, they also noted, was a mixture of old, original pre-World War II developments which stood near the entrance to the avenue at the junction with Burlington Avenue, and more recent 1960s housing which stood deeper within the avenue. Yet the recently built housing blended, both officers thought, sensitively with the original houses. Carmen Farrow and Thompson Ventnor left the car after securely locking it and walked up the short and narrow front path of number 237. Carmen Farrow knocked on the blue-painted front door using the soft yet still authoritative police officer's knock of tap, tap, tap. There was no immediate response. Farrow and Ventnor glanced at each other, and Farrow was about to knock a second time, when at that moment, movement was to be heard from within the house, in the manner of an internal door being opened with a distinct click and then shut. Moments later the front door was opened, and a short and finely made woman stood on the threshold of the house. She had noted the two officers' gaunt and drawn features, piercing green eyes, and straggly uncombed grey hair, which reached to her shoulders. She wore a long black dress, the hem of which hung just below her knees, revealing thin calves, which stopped in heavy black, sensible shoes. The woman wore a necklace of multicoloured plastic beads, which she had looped twice round her long neck, and she wore equally inexpensive plastic bangles around each wrist. "Yes?" she said, with a trace of curiosity, but without any trace at all of fear or alarm caused by the two strangers who had suddenly presented themselves on her doorstep. "Police?" Carmen Farrow held up her ID card. Ventnor did the same. "All right," the woman replied after glancing at each card. "I can see you're genuine. Is there some trouble?" "Mrs. Graham?" Farrow asked. "Mrs. Anne Graham?" "Miss. But yes, Miss Anne Graham. I dare say that you'll be calling about the murder of the Middleton family all those years ago."